Welcome to the last regular session of Socialism 2009 before the final rally. Thank you all for coming, and hopefully people already heard the announcement that this is the meeting on what would socialism look like. The meeting on fighting racism in the Obama era has been moved to the Women's Building auditorium. So I want to welcome everybody to this meeting. My name is Bob Inez. I'm an ISO member in San Diego. We're going to be covering a topic today which has become surprisingly more timely over the last year, as ideas of socialism, often in distorted form, have re-entered the mainstream discourse. And I think it's important that we put forth our idea of what we think socialism would look like. So Regina Johnson is going to be introducing the topic. She is has been an activist in the LGBT struggle, as well as many other struggles over the last 6 years in the Bay Area, including Palestinian solidarity work, anti-war work, and she's also an artist, and she's going to be going ahead and introducing this, so I'll go ahead and turn it over to you.
Okay, great. Yeah. Well, thank you very much, everybody, for coming and participating in this discussion today. I don't think it would be proper to start off a discussion about what socialism would look like without talking about how horrible capitalism is. So today we have now 3 billion people living on less than $2.50 a day in the world. 100 million people have been added to this list in the last couple months due to the economic crisis. And this is at the same time as the top wealthiest 10 people in the United States of America, 10 people, Adam Turrell did this fantastic spread in the SW a couple weeks ago. It's like 0.0000003% of the population own the combined wealth of $280 billion. And yeah, it wasn't added up in the article, and I added it up, and it was horrifying. So, and this is at the same time as 1%, so basically, you know, a couple hundred more people than that, of the U.S. population has more wealth than the combined 40% of the population in the United States. And according to UNICEF now, 25,000 children die each day of poverty in the world. When I first joined the ISO 6 years ago, that number was 17,000. What that number calculates to is 1,041 children die per hour, 17 children minute die per minute. And this doesn't exclude the United States. 25% of children in the United States live in poverty. And we've seen the unemployment rate rise here in the United States. Now states are seeing over 10%, and we know that those numbers are drastically higher than what they report. The U.S. has lost 6.5 billion jobs since the recession began in 2007, and this has turned millions and millions of people pushed into poverty here in the United States. They have lost their homes due to being scapegoated and put into foreclosure or into mortgages that they couldn't afford, and it's pushed thousands of people into the street and into homelessness. And I just really want to point out this article in the center spread of the current SW is so telling, and what one of the folks says who's living in this tent city in Seattle is what we socialists have said for a long time. A gentleman, Nick, who lives in the camp, and he's been there for a few years, 2 years, because of a debilitating accident that cut off his livelihood as a carpenter 3 years ago. In a soft-spoken way, Nick said, simply, we need more housing. You can't just get rid of homelessness. You can't have rich people without poor people. And I think this is really important to contrast to basically the Newsweek article a couple weeks ago that basically said the Capitalist Manifesto, greed is good. And they started off basically making fun of the Communist Manifesto because, as we know, Newsweek ran the article a few months ago basically about the return of socialism, that we are all socialists now. But the last paragraph of this article said, quite astoundingly, we are all in the midst of a vast crisis, and there is enough blame to go around and many fixes to make, from the international system to the national governments to private firms. But at heart, there needs to be a deeper fix within all of us, a simple gut check. If it doesn't feel right, we shouldn't be doing it. That's not going to restore growth or mend globalization or save capitalism. And it might be a small, but it might be a start, small start to sanity. And they, you know, they basically want us to do a gut check around this as well. But I think the exact opposite is actually in order. So the economic crisis has exposed the drastic inequality that we see in the world today. Capitalism, a system based on profit and minority rule over one class over the majority, will never meet the needs of the world's population. Karl Marx, whose ideas are quite popular again, and I just heard we have over 880 people who have attended this conference. Goes to show you his ideas were right. He identified capitalist crisis as a crisis of overproduction and overcapacity. He said pointedly in the Communist Manifesto, "In these crises, there breaks out an epidemic that in all earlier epochs would have seemed an absurdity, the epidemic of overproduction. Society suddenly finds itself put back into a state of momentary barbarism. It appears as if in famine. A universal war of devastation had cut off the supply of every means of subsistence. Industry and commerce seem to be destroyed. And why? Because there is too much civilization, too much means of subsistence, too much industry, and too much commerce." So I believe that capitalism has definitely run its course, and socialism is the only rational solution to all the problems that we face today. Marx detailed how the productive forces of capitalism are in conflict with the social forces. The unplanned economy of capitalism will always cause crisis and will always cause inequality. Booms and slumps of the market occur at the expense of ordinary working people. But the good thing is that these modes of production under capitalism have developed to a point where there is enough surplus to raise every person's standard of living. And this was not actually possible in previous societies. So along with this material basis for socialism, capitalism has also created the social basis for socialism to be a reality. For the first time, a class has developed that is the vast majority of the world's population and has the interest to create a society without classes and exploitation. Paul D'Amato explains this dynamic in The Meaning of Marxism. "By the virtue of its collective and social weight, the working class is the first exploited class in history with the capacity to reorder society in the interests of the majority. Workers can't divide up the factories, the hospitals, and offices and share them out individually as peasants with the land. You can't parcel out an assembly line. The only way workers can abolish the conditions of exploitation is to collectivize and socialize the means of production and distribution." So the problem is that the distribution of this surplus under capitalism, which is actually created by the workers, which I just talked about, lies in the hands of a minority of people and does not, therefore, benefit the vast majority of people who produce the wealth. Now, before I go on to what actually socialism is, I'd like to talk just a little bit about what it is not. Some people from the right, we've heard it throughout the newspapers since Obama became president, they call him a socialist because he said he will raise taxes. And he has bailed out the banks to what will actually end up being $1 trillion. But higher taxes does not equate to socialism, although we're all for it. Obviously, people have seen the shirts that we're selling over there in the store. This would be the way that we would save our schools, we would stop layoffs, and we would get free health care. Socialism is also not just about nationalizing the banks. Even Timothy Geithner, Obama's Treasury Secretary, admits this, that Obama is just trying to save the system. The misconception is that state control of the economy equals socialism. Karl Marx did call for the state ownership of the economy, of the financial system, in the 10 measures that he lays out in the Communist Manifesto. But first, Marx said, the working class must carry out a social revolution and win political control of society. Then with this political control, it must implement the measures to start this transition to socialism. So social democracy, which I don't know if people got to see the talk yesterday, was phenomenal on Sweden. It structures the political system, but it does not structure the economy. So this is not socialism. I wish it were that easy. The workers do not control the state in Sweden, nor do they control the economy. They simply live in a capitalist society with a very generous welfare state. But just like here, over the last 30 years, those benefits have been getting cut back. Now, another dominant idea is that socialism has been tried and failed. But again, this comes from the wrong idea that just state ownership equals socialism. The USSR was not a socialist country. It ceased being so in the late 1920s. The successful workers' revolution of 1917 did not succeed. One, because you can't have socialism in one country, and the revolution wasn't able to spread. Two, there was scarcity of food. People were starving. You can't have socialism when people are starving. And three, 14 imperial armies invaded Russia after it was already devastated by World War II. So what would real socialism look like? I want to start with the economy, because I think that's the base of the type of society that we want to build. Marx said that a social society would be built by the hands, brains, and creativity of the people who made the revolution, that we can't and shouldn't try to make a blueprint for what society would be. I'd be really interested to see what he has to say about the fact that I'm going to have slides later. But it's an important. I think it's very important for us to have an idea of what kind of world we're actually fighting for. And mostly, I really hope this talk inspires people and raises expectations about what we can expect to achieve if we actually organize and fight for this better world. Also, I want this talk to start to provide some answers around human nature and why it isn't actually a barrier to socialism. Now, one of the reasons why Marx didn't want to make a blueprint for a socialist world is because many other socialists during that time were actually coming up with many blueprints. Utopian socialists who spent their time dreaming of a socialist society that would emerge out of the ideas of a few great men from up on high. Now, this was the opposite of what Marx talked about. Marx was interested in how a socialist society would come about by class struggle and conflict and the self-activity of the vast majority of people in the world. Marx believed that emancipation of the working class must be the act of the working class itself. Now, I'm sure many people have heard us say a socialist in a shorthand way. We want a society without classes. We want a democratic society where the wealth is distributed, the wealth I just talked about. We constantly say that there is this enough money to go around to feed the world and house and clothe everyone, and also give everyone a decent education and free health care. Now, how would this come about? And where would this money come from? Well, first off, Marx scientifically detailed how profit under capitalism actually comes from workers' unpaid labor. Workers produce more value in a day than is necessary for their livelihood. And under capitalism, the bosses profit this surplus that workers produce. Under capitalism, society's wealth has become consolidated in the form of property, which is very key, into fewer and fewer hands, which has caused this drastic inequality. There was a consolidation of power through the creation of nation states, judicial systems, and laws. States essentially developed to keep the ruling class in power and to protect their property rights. Therefore, the abolition of private property and the end of class exploitation is an intrinsic part of a socialist society. It is through the abolition of private property and the collectivization of wealth, the wealth-creating mechanisms, which Marx called the means of production, that classes will disappear. In the Communist Manifesto, Marx passionately went after the ruling class when they questioned the idea of getting rid of property rights. He said, "You are horrified at our intending to do away with private property, but in your existing society, private property is already done away with for 9/10 of the population. Its existence for the few is solely due to the non-existence in the hands of those 9/10. Which is quite amazing, because he said this 150 years ago in the Communist Manifesto. Now, in terms of private property, we're not talking about I'm going to go out and grab your iPods and go to your house and take your televisions. We're actually talking about factories, hospitals, and schools, and offices. Now, under socialism, the chaos of the market and this profit-driven economy would be replaced by a planned economy. It's through the collectivization and the socialization of private property and the means of production that then labor will actually be liberated, meaning we will have control over what we create, how we create it, and how it gets distributed. This is essentially the planned economy, producing things that society actually needs versus production for the purposes of profit and economic competition. Eric Ruder describes this in his article on socialism in the last ISR. He said, "The accumulated savings of society would not be handed over to a class of people, unelected and unaccountable, to invest for the purpose of their private gain. Instead, the economic output of society would be used to address the social needs of the producers themselves." Now, John Molyneux, in his great pamphlet, The Future of Socialist Society, he went on to say, quote, "This plan will not be a rigid scheme imposed from above. The working class must be the subject, not the object of this plan. The planning process will begin at the base, in workplace meetings, factory councils, workers' councils, with a determination of people's needs and priorities and an assessment of the productive capacity of each workplace. Now, I would say under a socialist society and a planned economy, we would put an end to the $1 trillion spent on advertising and the absurdity of the luxuries of the rich. I don't know if everyone got a chance to see Mark Steele on Thursday night talking about how the rich, you know, wants to protect and clean their moats and their duck ponds and things like that. Or there's, you know, stories of gold toilets and all of the millions of yacht collections that rich people have. And, you know, this last year, there was a $1 billion 25-story mansion that was built in India by the richest person. So under a planned economy, we would opt to use the resources and surplus that industrialization and technological innovation provides us with to care for the world's population with good, healthy food, clothing, healthcare, and shelter for everyone who lives on this planet. So for instance, I was just looking up the latest homeless figures in San Francisco. There are currently 7,000 documented homeless people who are living in San Francisco. That estimate could be up to 15,000, you know, if we were able to count everyone. So I would say as I'm walking down the street, all the empty buildings and housing and stuff like that, we should actually put people in those houses. We would opt to do that under socialism. And people dying of curable diseases would actually not exist because there would be universal free healthcare with a premium put on preventative care. And my friend Lori Beth here, I called her the other day to ask her, because she has worked as an EMT, an emergency medical technician, how healthcare would change under socialism. And she said, now people do not call an ambulance or see the doctor because they won't be able to pay the bill. People wait until they have pneumonia because they don't want to pay to get antibiotics. If we had a system where someone is sick, they see a doctor, they get their medicine, the first day they were feeling ill, then things would just get better instead of taking days and days to get over an illness which could have been prevented in the first place. Which, as someone with a bad cold right now, I can attest to that. But so along with socialism providing basic needs for everyone under this planned economy, I very much believe that this well-distributed surplus would make oppression unnecessary in society. Human beings are not born to be sexist, racist, homophobic, nationalist, or individualistic. Oppression plays an important role under capitalism. It keeps us divided as a working class so we don't organize together and actually realize who our real enemy is. It keeps us blaming each other for the horrible lives that we live. Also, the system of capitalism economically gains from institutionalizing oppression, sexism, racism, homophobia, by having a portion of the workplace paid a lower wage. It also keeps the ruling class from having to pay for social services and equal education. This is especially true when you think about how racism has meant people of color disproportionately are forced to live in poorer neighborhoods. And rarely get a chance at getting a decent education or a good paying job. And there are also a disproportionate number of people who are living in prison and death row. Capitalism banks on unemployment to breed this competition and to have a flexible labor force for the booms and slumps of the economy. Also, the nature of the way that the family developed under capitalism means that the oppression of women is an intrinsic feature of the system. So the women's role in making sure the family cares for the next generation of workers has meant she has gotten trapped for the burden of an immense amount of unpaid labor in the home. And this is why free restaurants, communal laundry, and daycare will be a central demand and a human right in a socialist society. Yeah. And rethinking and replacing the family with a society that sees care for children as a social responsibility will also help not only eliminate sexism, but will also get rid of homophobia. Ideas around gender and sexual relationships will no longer be an issue in a society where everyone is looked at as an equal contributor and where child rearing is a responsibility of the society as a whole. Now, getting rid of oppression will not happen in one fell swoop, and it's not going to just happen if we snap our fingers, but it's part of a very long process leading up to the revolution. In fact, a successful socialist revolution will not happen unless we overcome these divisions between working people. And it is the movements that we are engaged in here and now and in the future that lay the foundation for getting rid of oppression. as people's ideas change about each other, and solidarities forge on picket lines, in meetings, and protest, regardless of someone's skin color, gender identity, or sexual orientation. Similarly, I believe with a planned economy, wars would not exist. The erasing of state borders and militaries will happen because state borders and militaries function as a means to steal resources and protect property rights and wealth. A socialist society will allow for people to travel openly to all continents. Then we can create a world of human cooperation and exchange and a sharing of ideas across continents. Thank you. And under a rational economy, we can put an end to waste and destruction caused by war, to the tune of $1 trillion that the U.S. currently expends in its arms race and all the science and technology that it uses. So instead, science and technology could be used to better human beings' lives, to the creation of medicine for curable diseases, and creating a sustainable environment. Now, I don't believe that this is utopian. And many people, I think, can actually look at all this and say, I can see how this would happen. I can see actually how we could get a planned economy to work. They can see that that wealth is there and that actually we should possibly redistribute it. But the big question, I think, for a lot of people is whether or not socialism will actually work with human nature. Aren't people naturally greedy, violent, competitive, and selfish? Now, I can definitely match anyone here in this room, story for story, about all the horrible, selfish, violent, and greedy things that have happened to me in my life or my loved ones. And in fact, I'm not perfect like a lot of you. I have horrible stories, ways that I've acted in the past where I've been competitive with friends, coworkers, or even been jealous of comrades because of my own insecurities and underconfidence, you know? But is this how we were born, or is this how actually capitalism has taught us to be this way in order to justify our its own selfishness, its own greed, violence, and competition? When you look at who's the worst at all these so-called human traits, I would say a rich person who's the CEO of a corporation who sacks tens of thousands of his employees to increase his profit margin is more greedy than the person who walks down the street and doesn't have a buck to give to a homeless person. Or the politician or president who votes to send an army over to another country and bomb millions of people is more violent than the person who abuses their partner because they are mentally distraught over bills and their ability to feed their family. Under capitalism, we have been taught certain morals. We have been conditioned to think about what is right or wrong because it benefits those people in power. The ruling class cannot afford to rule by force all the time, so they actually have to foster these ideas about how we look at the world and how we look at each other's actions in order to try and control us. So how would our ideas change under socialism? Marx said, this whole semblance that the rule of a certain class is only the rule of a certain ideas comes to a natural end. Of course, as soon as society ceases at last to be organized in the form of class rule, that is to say, as soon as it is no longer necessary to represent the general interest as ruling. So the ideas that are important to perpetuate under capitalism, sexism, racism, homophobia, gender roles, nuclear family, individuality, selfishness, material gain, and desires and needs that actually center around objects would not exist, because these are all things that intrinsically help capitalism keep working. What we consider as human nature under capitalism will change under socialism. Humans are not static beings. We are not animals. We are capable of conscious thought. We have the ability to change and develop our ideas throughout our lives. And what makes us unique? Our ability to work and our ability to transform our environment and understand the surroundings and adapt to them. Marx described human nature as the following. Nature is not a purely biological one and not an abstraction. It is one which can be understood only historically because it unfolds in history. And what is in our environment under capitalism? First off, capitalism creates alienation because we are forced to sell our labor in order to live, and our labor, like everything else under capitalism, is a commodity. At the same time, we are separated from these products that we produce with our labor. And this actually has an enormous effect on every aspect of our lives. The system of capitalism essentially, above all, focuses on profit versus human development. When Marx talked about alienation, he said this, within the capitalist system, all methods for raising the social productiveness of labor are brought about at the cost of the individual laborer. All means for the development of production transform themselves into a means of domination over and exploitation of the producers. They mutilate the laborer into a fragment of a man, degrade him to the level of an appendage of a machine, destroy every remnant of charm in his work, and turn it into a hated toil. They estrange from him the intellectual potentialities of the labor process in the same proportion as science is incorporated into it as an independent power. So because labor is not our own under capitalism, there are whole chunks of our lives that feel completely stolen from us and drain us rather than engage our minds and our hearts and creative spirits. Brian Jones said this wonderfully in the Socialist Worker newspaper. Imagine a bird that hates to fly, or a fish that loathes nothing more than swimming, and you have an idea of just what kind of alienated creatures we are. Living under a system that makes us hate working. So one of the arguments, and I hope some of this has gone into that already, against a planned economy is that people would not have the incentive to work. Nor without competition would we have the advancements that we have seen under capitalism. But first off, we have to look at the way capitalism treats work in order to understand how people's inspiration to work would change under socialism. Capitalism has taken all the joy out of our work because it has separated this intellectual labor from manual labor. And under socialism, we would unite those things again. A culture would be created where every person feels their participation is important, from individuals, old and young, from children, from people with health issues, and even with people with disabilities. Having a democratic and planned economy would change our relationship to our work. Molyneux explained what effect a planned economy would have on labor as the following. First off, the working week will be systematically reduced. Under capitalism, advances in technologies are used to displace workers. We see the combination of millions of workers on overtime at the same time as millions are unemployed. With socialist planning, the total work week required would be shared equally, and every technological advance will lessen the amount of physical work that is needed. Secondly, automation will be used to eliminate the most unpleasant and menial jobs. Thirdly, the division of labor will be progressively overcome. So under capitalism, you're expected to pick a job and stick to it your whole life, even though your interests actually change throughout your life. In a planned economy, there will be more space for people to switch around jobs, especially since education will be free. You can continue educating yourself your whole life, which will make it easy to switch around and do different things and make work much more creative and exciting again. So people would enjoy their job a lot more because of this. Because under capitalism, what does our labor do? It just makes someone money, and that actually doesn't escape the vast majority of people in the world. So even under capitalism, if you feel like you're in a work position where you can contribute to society, this is stifled by the needs for profit. For instance, teachers, many people become teachers because they actually think they can contribute and help children kind of grow up and live better, you know, in this crazy life. But if you don't have ample support and resources, adequate school sizes, if you're expected to teach a classroom of 20 plus students, how can one person really expect to do under this system? Or 30 or 40? Yeah. So I asked my friend AJ to basically describe how education would be transformed under socialism, and she said the following. Education in a socialist society could provide the maximum amount of freedom for each individual to explore talents, interests, and curiosities, and develop skills because it would be democratically run by students and teachers who collaborate to produce education. It would be freed of all the baggage that is currently strangling education, such as testing mandates that line the pockets of assessment and textbook CEOs. Also, students would not arrive at school hungry, sick, and in competition with their fellow students, and alienated from their own education. So I've included this quote, and I have a couple other like this, to show that even workers under capitalism have an idea of how their industry or their area of work could improve. We don't need bosses and CEOs to tell us how to do our job better. We just need the resources and the ability for democratic collaboration. Now, some of you may still be thinking, aren't people still just a little bit too fucked up for socialism? No, I mean, you know, capitalism does some horrible, horrible things to people, and I understand that. Marxists get accused of not addressing, actually, how messed up people are. We're called dogmatic sometimes because we focus on changing the economic structure of society versus, say, telling someone they should go and get their head examined before they're ready to fight. But Marxists believe that our ideas and the way we see ourselves and each other will change during struggle. In the process of fighting together, we break down the individualism and a lot of the issues of confidence and insecurity and stereotypes that have been taught to us by the world that we live in. In essence, it's this process that makes us become fit to rule. And one beautiful example I pulled was from Todd Kreishan's article on Lenin's theory of the party that was in the ISR. He said, one wonderful counterexample to workers' suffering took place in Poland during the Solidarity strike of 1980. There, the Stalinist system had a policy of sticking workers who drank too much or didn't show up to work on time or at all in the psychiatric wards. Clearly, anyone who didn't arrive sober and on time to work at 5 a.m. at the shipyard welding depot in January, when the Baltic Sea is frozen solid, had some sort of mental illness. I mean, how could life get better than that? But when millions of workers join the strike and mass protest aimed at bringing a more human face to the so-called Polish communism, a funny thing happens. Many of those workers who were branded as depressed or antisocial suddenly felt much better. They checked themselves out of the hospitals and they joined the movement. They wanted to participate. They felt confident. They felt like they were not just pawns. They had a voice. Even a little dose of workers' power can cure a lot of ailments workers pick up from capitalism. Okay, great. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. So, I believe we can create a world where the best human instincts of compassion, love, and solidarity are fostered. This will happen because the distortion and alienation that is also brought about by money in our culture will disappear under socialism. Marx described this quite pointedly. Money transforms fidelity into infidelity, love into hate, hate into love, virtue into vice, vice into virtue, servant into master, master into servant, idiocy into intelligence, and intelligence into idiocy. He who can buy bravery is brave, though he be a coward. I mostly wanted to think of the ruling class when I read this quote, and George Bush in particular. So how do we get rid of money? Under a socialist society, there will gradually be no need for money because wages and private property would not exist. This would be possible because we will reach a point of having an abundance of essential goods produced in society. As Molyneux describes in the Future Socialist Society pamphlet, from the start, the socialist revolution will produce a great equalization in the distribution of goods compared with the massive inequalities built into capitalism. The enormous accumulations of wealth deriving from exploitation and property ownership will be expropriated. Progressively, socialism will increase the production of an ever wider range of goods to the point where supply exceeds demand. It will then become impossible to cease selling goods and distributing them on the basis of need. Money, seemingly the all-powerful god of capitalist society, but is in reality only a means by which the products of human labor are exchanged. This will steadily lose its usefulness to a point where it can be dispensed with altogether. Now, this might be hard to imagine, but imagine if you walk into a grocery store where there are just hundreds of oranges that can't be sold for a profit before they rot. Why then would you not want to just give those away versus throwing them out? Any normal human being would actually see that. So think of this abundance actually spreading throughout society. There would be no need for money exchange if all the other basic needs are taken care of. Money under capitalism dictates our needs. And we trick ourselves into believing what our needs are and what our needs are not based on whether or not we can afford to purchase objects or have the time to enjoy certain aspects of society. And this will all change once all human beings, along with our basic needs, have access to amazing education, science and travel, music, art. I mean, you can't even imagine how our needs will actually be transformed. And we can say for certain that socialism will cultivate the human senses. Marx detailed the limitation of our senses in human development in general under capitalism when he was talking about alienation. For the starving man, it is not the human form of food that exists, but only the abstract existence of food. It could just as well be there in its crudest form, and it would be impossible to say wherein this feeding activity differs from that of animals. The care-burdened, poverty-stricken man who has no sense for the finest play, The dealer in minerals sees only the commercial value, but not the beauty and the specific character of that mineral. He has no mineralogical sense. It's quite philosophical, but it's interesting, you know. As we go beyond the survival of day-to-day life under capitalism, beyond the buying and selling of things, our interaction with the world and the development of ourselves as creative beings will change and grow. Imagine when everyone knows what good food tastes like, what it feels like to walk through a rainforest, what it feels like to watch the sunset every evening if you wanted to. I don't know why, it's just so beautiful. What it feels like to look at art for hours and then discuss this with friends and loved ones. To go to an opera and actually be able to enjoy it and appreciate it and not actually think that this is just bourgeois art. I mean, for the first time I ever listened to an opera in the park for free, it blew my mind. And this is the type of society we're talking about building. Mm-hmm. Now, I've talked a lot about how society will change for the individual without alienated labor. Now I want to end with talking about how society as a whole could change under socialism. And I'm going to get into this in a sec, but I know it's unorthodox, but I'm going to use some slides for the last part of my presentation. So, first slide, please.
By the way, full screen.
I'm sorry. No, I don't know if it's going to do that. Wait, stop. Actually, just here. If you do this, you can click through. Okay. So, click on this.
That's
right here.
It's inactive.
Oh.
SON presentation.
We're not looking.
Okay, now, roll. Got it. Okay. So, first one. Okay. The Jetsons. Okay. Now, when I was first thinking about this talk, I thought about the Jetsons. Because I don't know if anybody grew up with watching the Jetsons. But then I went back and I watched a couple episodes. So, meet George Jetson, his boy Elroy, daughter Judy, Jane, his wife. So, I was like, flying cars, cool. That was the thing that I was really excited about. Robots that clean your house, doubly cool. But if any of you are Battlestar Galactica fans, we know what happens when you use robots who can talk and are conscious beings for work. So you might not want to do that. conveyor belt that takes George to work, kind of cool, you know, fits on that in his briefcase. But nuclear family, bad. Wife Jane has to stay at home all day while George works, bad. George has a dumb boss that asks him to do stupid stuff all day and work on his days off. Bad. People who are thieving space cars and shopping all the time for fun with their space credit cards. Totally bad. So it's basically capitalism. Okay, thanks. So there will be things in society that will that would be the same and some things that would change. I think we want to use all the machinery, technology, and the urban cities we've created in a better and more humane way. I don't think we want to pack people up and send them out to the countryside for little rural utopias. But again, that's going to be up for people to decide in the future. But I do think it's the fact that workers have built these cities, we should be able to run them more humanely. Also, we've become socialized beings through the development of capitalism, and I don't think we'll actually go back around this question. So I want to quote Trotsky. He wrote an amazing book, various books on art and culture, art and literature and revolution. And he described a future socialist society as this. All forms of life, such as the cultivation of land, the planning of human habitats, the building of theaters, the methods of socially educating children, the solution of scientific problems, the creation of new styles, will virtually engross all and everybody. People will divide up into parties over the question of a new gigantic canal or the distribution of an oasis in the Sahara. Such a question will exist too. Over the regulation of the weather and the climate, over a new theater, over chemical hypotheses, over two competing tendencies in music, and over the best system of sports. It will have no running after of profits. It will have nothing mean, no betrayals, no bribery, none of the things that form the soul of competition in a socially divided into a society divided into classes. But this will in no way hinder the struggle from being absorbing, dramatic, and passionate. and as all problems in a socialist society will become the property of all people. One can say with certainty that collective interests and passions and individual competition will have the widest scope and the most unlimited opportunity. Now, every person will learn to be a participant in society. Everything under capitalism tells us to be a passive person. This would be the opposite under socialism. We are told that our political participation only needs to happen every year or 2 years or 4 years when we go and vote on the next president or mayor or some proposition. This would drastically change in a socialist society. Under socialism, with a planned economy, we would democratically get together with our coworkers, our neighbors, and our community members and decide what we produce and how we produce it. Real democracy would involve participation with everyone, and there would be time to do this because, as I mentioned earlier, child rearing would be all of society's responsibility, and we would just work less in order to allow for people to participate. The democratic structures, workers' councils, or Soviets that develop out of working class struggle and revolution would be the basis for this new political and organizational structure under socialism. Strike committees within factories developed into workers' councils as a way of organizing our side against the bosses. This has happened historically. And it's not automatic that these workers see these organizations as the basis for constructing a new democratic society and the political structure that actually allows workers to seize power from the ruling class in revolution. But time and time again, these organizations have sprung up throughout history, from the Paris Commune in 1871, Russia in 1905 and 1917, to Chile in 1972, to Iran in 1970, to Poland in 1980. Various other examples exist, including here in the United States, where in 1934, workers basically ran their cities, one of the largest being the Teamsters Rebellion in Minneapolis. And I would love to read some quotes for you, but I'm just running a little bit on time, so I hope people can bring that up a lot more in the discussion. But unlike under capitalism, all leadership would be elected and instantly recallable and would be elected from your peers. Therefore, the leadership and the decisions made by them are accountable to their friends and loved ones and community members. So imagine having councils in your building where you live to decide on what issues affect you and your neighbors. Imagine having a delegate elected from your building, and then they represent your issues at a council meeting in the neighborhood to decide if there needs to be more effort and time spent to fix the street signage, or you need another hospital in your neighborhood, or you need more public transit lines. Like, this would be the type of thing that would be possible, and it would go on and on until you could decide whether or not community parks are in your area, or more playgrounds, or even more housing. So now I'm going to go ahead and start the slide presentation a little bit. And what I'm going to try to do, you can click to the next one. I'm not trying to prescribe what socialism is in any way, but I want to inspire with some ideas, basically, that people have looked at throughout society, both creative individuals. There have been architects who have wanted to develop urban planning. This particular person here basically is Paolo Soleri. He's an Italian architect. Many of you have known him, but he basically wanted cities to be in the image of man. So, the idea that things would be closer to us, the idea that we would have basically educational spaces right next to our living spaces and theaters and art and all sorts of things. But this was actually an amazing space called Arco Sante. It's in the middle of being built in Arizona. People may have seen it. Now, he was a utopian kind of socialist, but he also had ideas for cities. But unfortunately, under capitalism, you actually can't develop it like that. We can't just bulldoze down, the IBM corporation and then put in these amazing structures. But those are things people will be able to decide in the future. So it's quite amazing. This here, if you can flip to the next one. So these are studios and roof gardens and residences and stuff. And down here are theaters and workspaces and housing, housing structures. And down here are more theaters and stuff. It's just quite amazing, the ideas that people have had throughout history about how, we can basically live in a more humane way. And if you can go to the next one, unfortunately, it's a sad thing because this space is only like a tenth built because it's all done via private funding. He wanted no money from corporations, so people actually go there for the summer and help build this thing. But it's a cool space, but this is one of the theater spaces that's actually built. You can go to the next one. And these are actually apartment buildings that look out on that theater space. So, I don't know, I think it's important for us to envision some of these things when we're thinking about yeah, what sort of stuff can develop. You can go to the next one. One more thing. Can you go back? The other important thing to say about this is all like without a carbon footprint too. The way that this was designed is the way that the sun comes in a certain area. So heating and cooling and everything, it's all self-contained within this unit. There's solar energy, there's greenhouses that basically trap warmth that then later basically heats buildings and stuff. So, and this was 30 years ago before even global warming, it's, the ideas that came out about this. So you can keep going. Now this is Corbusier. Some people may know him. He was directly inspired by a lot of the building that came out of the Russian Revolution. It seems kind of static, but in the 1930s this was developed in France. But this was supposed to be affordable housing, and because of that, never were built on a massive scale. This is all along the bottom is green space, so that people actually have access to green spaces, and the whole top is a rooftop garden, and this whole inside space is actually kind of communal common spaces and stuff. So ideas that don't even exist in our apartment buildings now. You can go to the next one. This is the passive house, and there's a great article by Chris Williams in a past ISR that he talks about this. It was designed in Germany, and many thousands have been built, but not enough. The house, which looks like any other house from the outside, is super insulated and so well designed that it does not need an active heating or cooling system either. This type of house uses 3/4 less energy than a typical building. We'll go on. Okay, this is kind of funny. So, it's not funny. It's just like, I think another thing that we're going to want is massive public transportation lines throughout our cities. And I think if I could have researched, I could have pulled up images of Switzerland because they have some of that in their city structures already. A lot of their cities, the public transportation actually goes under the city structure and it doesn't even interfere with the ground itself. But another idea that I think will exist is shared, if there are cars that need, we should actually share them. And this isn't something new. City Car Share has over dozens, basically, of these little pods within San Francisco. So you can go and you can rent a car, basically, for an hour and go get something you need if you need for longer distances and you can't get there quickly. So I think there's, again, innovations that people are making. But again, it's not possible in a grand scale because of the profit system. Okay. Going. How am I doing? Getting very close?
Close to the ground.
Okay, close. Okay, I'll keep going. So I'll just keep clicking through. Okay, this is amazing. So there's so many innovations that have been made already around solar energy and wind power and stuff like that under capitalism. This is very close by where I live in the Mojave Desert. This is actually the largest solar power plant and actually provides enough power for a city of 250,000 people. And this basically just goes on for, it's not very big. It's basically, I would say, less than a mile by a mile. So you can think about the type of, if we actually use some of these desert spots to like have renewable energy resources, it's something that's completely possible. So the next. These are amazing. This is actually already being developed. These are these giant wind turbines that is off the Scottish North Sea. And you can't tell, but some of them are so large that basically if you had a helicopter, it's this big compared to what the turbines look like. So I think, again, thinking of ideas people would want to have, if you had these sort of turbines outside of in the ocean outside of cities rather than oil plants, you can see how actually the environment would get changed very quickly from sustainable energy. So I think I'm probably going to... agriculture is something that would affect, obviously we have the monoculture industry here now that is swept, unfortunately, the food industry. And there's a movement actually called Campesino a Campesino, Farmer to Farmer, where it's a solidarity movement where they actually share seeds and history and agriculture. I think we would want to go back to actually farmers talking about how to produce food and doing it in organic and natural ways. So I think I'm running very close to time. I'm not going to get through a lot more of my slides. So maybe I'll go just a couple more real quick.
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
No minds? Okay. Okay. Vote. Everyone okay with that? Okay. Okay. So the next one. Okay. So I think we have yet to even, begin to comprehend what and how humans will create in a society, because we've been so raped of creativity in our mental facilities. But it's also important to look at past revolutions. This is from the Russian Revolution. Many people may know Alexander Rodchenko's designs. But what lots of folks may not know is that actually the design, the architecture, the printmaking, the art, everything that came out of the Russian Revolution, and this was, you know, a revolution that wasn't able to foster and turn into socialism because they didn't have that material basis, but still it inspired the whole modernist movement. Everything that we have today, like what graphic design looks like today, is because of the art that came out of the Russian Revolution. There were amazing technologies in terms of and ideas about collaging image and typography and stuff. That later, actually, even you can click to the next one. People know this one and the next one. This is Elazitsky, which people know, you know, which is the famous red. I'm so dyslexic, I get it mixed up. Beat the whites with the red wedge. And he was actually, you know, head of kind of the architecture. And there were so many art and architectural councils that came out of the Russian Revolution. And he actually traveled a lot to the Bauhaus, which was a group of people within Germany where there also was revolutionary fever, and actually collaborated and were inspired by each other's ideas and kind of spread them out. And that's how, like, Corbusier, like I talked about earlier, got some of those ideas. So click through to the next one. Yeah, these are some of his amazing, like, poetry formations and stuff. But this inspired actually how architecture looked. People were like, okay, if you can start to put images and graphics and things on its side, why can't we do that with buildings? Why do buildings have to be so straight? So you started to see actually inspiration of buildings that had diagonals and various light spaces and all sorts of things that were developed because of the inspiration that came from artists out of the Russian Revolution. So you can keep going. Yeah, so this is hilarious. This is Lady Gaga, which many of you know. So one of the things I talked about earlier is basically how our needs will transform under socialism. And Trotsky describes art as the most as the utmost advancement of human emotion and personality, which will be the basis for a new socialist culture. Trotsky basically said that cultural needs are in their own way as real, like I just said, as any other needs. So this is a quote he had. Even a successful solution of the elementary problems of food, clothing, shelter, and even literacy would in no way signify a complete victory of a new historic principle, that is, of socialism. Only a movement of scientific thought on a national scale and the development of a new art would signify that the historic seed has not only grown into a plant, but has flowered. In this sense, the development of art is the highest test of vitality and significance of each epoch. So what will new art do? I just had some slides in here because I think there's some, you know, people, ways in which creativity, again, and kind of pop culture that takes shape and stuff. So one is Lady Gaga. I don't know if people know about her, but her and her friends, she's like a new pop singer and wasn't popular for a very long time. She actually studied as a classical pianist and then transformed now into pop culture. So she melds like classical piano playing, which she then does with her foot sometimes, which is kind of fun and crazy. But all of her outfits are personally designed by her. They're not designed by, you know, high-end designers. They're designed by her and her friends, and they do them for her, which I think is kind of cool. The next one is Project Runway. The reason why I put this up is two things. One, I think... One is the fact that so many people are interested in Project Runway and like want to watch it and are into the way that things are built and how people create, I think shows that need that people have and kind of that desire to be part of a larger creative process and to know more about how things are manufactured rather than just be like, hey, I just made this screw and this other person's going to put it into the thing and, you know, you know what I mean? Like, someone made this and this and eventually it'll get put together, like cars now. Everything's placed out in factories. I think the fact that people look at these and like, wow, that's how clothing is made. You can be creative about that. And then also it shows that you don't need to be some major fashion model or fashion star in order to create really beautiful, interesting things that are not normal, that are amazing, but you know what I mean, not a normal part of what we see every day. So the next one. Okay, this is actually, I don't know if people know who Christo and John Plott is. They're amazing. They basically develop site-specific installation art, and it's some of the most beautiful stuff you've ever seen. This project that they're working on right now is going to be a canopy over the Colorado River that basically will create this amazing kind of abstract view of people who are, you know, going down the river, and also be amazing for the hikers along the side. But the reason why I mostly put this in here is because they do this without any, they basically draw, like they draw these amazing amazing illustrations, they sell them, and they do it in order to be able to pay people wages who work on their projects. Like so many people come up and say, I just want to work on this, I love what you do, but they purposely like, you know, try to get enough to be able to pay people $15 to $20 an hour in order to install, you know, these projects. And also they did amazing things, like they wrapped the Reichstag, I don't know, can't pronounce that right. They wrap the islands around Florida. I mean, it kind of, to me, it was inspired by the Trotsky quote, this idea of like, we don't know actually how we're going to create. And also, it's accessible to people. It takes it art outside of just the museum, which I think we'll see a lot more of under socialism. I know I'm going on. Next, please. This is Charles and Ray Ames, just quickly. I mean, they actually, their whole, people may see these in modernist stores. They cost hundreds or thousands of dollars. That's not why they designed these. They designed these to basically give beautiful artistic design and furniture to ordinary working people. It would be mass-produced. It would be produced well, sustainable, and instead it is turned into this high-end commodity that only rich people can afford. But that never was Charles and Ray Ames, and Ray is actually the wife of Charles, and lots of people think she's a man because of sexism. But they produced all sorts of things like this, like, you know, educational toys for children, lots of things, and it just became this commodified thing. So, okay, lastly, just graffiti art, I think, is always an inspiration in terms of the way that people kind of create outside of the bounds of what capitalism allows and is kind of public and human and accessible to people and a commentary on the world that we live in. So I'll end, Aurelie will end with this quote real quick, and then I'll be done. Okay, this is another one by Trotsky. Okay. Man will make its purpose to master his own feelings, to raise his instincts to the height of consciousness, to make them transparent, to extend the wires of his will into hidden recesses, and thereby to raise himself to a new plane, to create a higher social biological type, or if you please, a Superman. It is difficult to predict the extent of self-government which the man of the future, women, whoever, people, may reach, or to the heights, or the heights to which he may carry his technique. Social construction and psychophysical education, self-education, will become two aspects of one and the same process. All the arts, literature, drama, painting, music, and architecture will lend this process beautiful form. More correctly, the shell in which the cultural construction and self-education of the communist man will be enclosed will develop all the vital elements of contemporary art to the highest point. Man will become immeasurably stronger, wiser, and subtler. His body will become more harmonized, his movements more rhythmic, his voice more musical. The forms of life will become dynamically dramatic. The average human type will rise to the heights of an Aristotle, a Goethe, or a Marx. And above this ridge, new peaks will rise.
Yay.
All right, thanks, Regina, for that awesome and inspiring talk.
Thank you.
I know I'm going to have a lot of hands. We have a limited time for discussion, so I will take questions and comments. If you have questions, please try to get them out early. Also, please try to keep comments brief, since we will have a lot of people and not as much time. So I hope that people can say where they say their name and where they're from when I call them. And with that, I'll start taking down hands.
Hearing your discussion, it made me think a lot about like the idea of spirituality and mm-hmm. how like spirituality is something that is informed by the material, but mm-hmm. also spirituality is something that can be incredibly liberating if designed within its beliefs, it has an understanding of material. And I think a really interesting, like a great quote by Reverend Wright, where he says, our theology determines our anthropology, which determines our sociology, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm getting like choked up. That was amazing. So the way that we view like God, the way that we view the universe as a whole, right? Whatever, however you see it, right? However you view the meaning of that design, the purpose of that design, is how you're going to view people and how you react with those people, mm-hmm. right? And so yep. I think that the church can be seen as something that is opposed to, you know, socialism, mm-hmm. we can also see it, or not necessarily the church, but like spirituality and like the idea of like a greater purpose for humankind is like really mm-hmm. liberatory. And I think also like that's not just in like our spirituality, but we can see that in the same way that we view nature. Like I watched Planet Earth and oh my gosh, if that is not like so distorted by the discourse of like the ruling class, like mm-hmm. talking about like the way that fish swim together as like, you know, like just like, I mean, talking about that as competition, mm-hmm. talking about that as like talking about like the way that like things in nature that we don't even know their language. We don't know mm-hmm. the language of like different species, like mm-hmm. like saying like we know exactly why they're acting the way that they're acting, because really if we look at nature, like you can call the workings of it like as capitalist, as like the survival of the fittest or whatever, right? But mm-hmm. but also nature really is based on the principles of diversity, of community, and mm-hmm. symbiotic relationships. Mm-hmm. And it is important that we take those lessons from nature. Mm-hmm. Like, as people have always said, we take lessons from nature, but we read nature for what it really is. That's how we design our society. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, gentlemen, right here.
Yeah, actually, in help asking this question, because I don't understand it well enough to ask the question. I've read pro-capitalist arguments that at the moment seem to make sense to me in terms of crisis determining the allocation of resources. Sometimes there's very complex things going on. Like if we want to build one of the buildings, one of the houses that you showed, mm-hmm. There's steel, there's glass, there's all sorts of resources that went into that, and to kind of try to rationally plan that, I just have a feeling, is it really possible? Or is it too complex? So I'm going to leave it there, because that's as far as I understand it, so mm-hmm. if you could address that somehow.
Okay, I had Cecile.
Thank you for bringing up that point of spirituality, because I feel like Marxist materialism sometimes gets counterposed with spirituality, and this spirituality isn't compatible with materialist Marxism, and I think that religion is not compatible, but I think spirituality can be, and actually needs to be welcomed, so thank you for that comment. I think that, from my personal perspective, I wasn't quite choked up, but I do think that this conversation, what is socialism going to look like as a debate, I mean, I keep hearing there's no blueprint, but the debate and sort of like the need to, like those slides, what I was going to say is that this conversation has been, for me, the most important conversation we've had this weekend, because we need that inspiration. We need that most people agree that socialism is the best possible option. They just don't mm-hmm. believe that it is a possible option. Mm-hmm. And so the more we talk about this is how it might look, the more inspired people will be, and the more, you have to have the light, you have to have that thing, that inspiring vision that people can be shooting for, versus these are all the things that socialism is not. Capitalism is bad, here's why it's bad, okay, we get that, like, we all get that, right? So, I think that even if there's no blueprint, I actually kind of get a little uncomfortable when I say there's no blueprint, because it seems like, we don't know, but we'll figure it out when we get there. I mean, it's kind of been left that way many times before, and then it fails, and that's been frustrating. Why don't we have these debates about what it might look like? I mean, we have models, we have people with creative designs, and even though they come up with lots of different things, just even talking about it makes people feel like certain things are possible. There's a lot more I would like to say, but other people won't speak. So.
Okay. You were next.
Hi, I'm Kristen. I'm from San Francisco. Before we get too far into what a future socialist society will look like, I wanted to talk about why we fight oppression now, because some of the more mainstream ways of explaining racism or sexism is to say that all white people oppress black people, all men oppress women, and it makes you have to defend that by saying, actually, white people don't benefit from racism, and men don't benefit from sexism, and the reason you should fight against this is because it's in your own individual interest to actually to do it so that your own personal life can get better. And that is absolutely true. However, the reason we should be fighting against racism, sexism, homophobia, and all the other oppressions is not because it's going to make your own personal individual life better, but because it's the concept of solidarity. We're fighting for a world where the way you decide what to do is based on a collective interest, and what's better for everyone is actually better for you. And so I just think that that's an important way to look at it. And then on another completely separate note, me and my housemate, before we eat dinner together, we've actually begun to do this thing where a lot of people might have grown up saying, like, race before dinner. And so we've changed it from, like, a religious thing to we say, before we enjoy this wonderful meal before us, let us take some time to appreciate all of the work and the workers that have gone into producing this for us from the beginning of the labor process in whatever country. It starts in to the transportation workers, to the people that sell it to you, and just recognizing some of the immense human work that goes into just creating these simple things. And so I'm working on making it a little more eloquent, but it's a really wonderful way to start.
Okay, I have Elizabeth.
No, I just wanted to say, this is a great talk, one thing. But I just did talk a little bit about some of the things you touched on about what makes this all possible, like what makes this transformation of society possible, why the revolutionary socialists.
Yep.
I feel like that's such an important part. Revolutionary situations, I mean, you sort of see people transforming and doing the things we're told we can't do, that we can't organize society. There's a great book out there about the general strike in Seattle about 1919, about how people organized to stop certain services from happening and to make certain services start happening, because, you know, in certain situations like that. And I also want to talk about 1905 just for a second, which is a great example of transformation of the way workers thought about themselves and what they could do. When workers' councils came up in 1905 in Russia, it's a great example where you had, you know, a situation where there was a lot of patriotism for the war, where people would be marching with red, white, and blue flags, and in a few months it transformed when people were organizing against the war and were marching with the ripped up the flags and were marching with the red part of the flag. And there were debates and there were discussions that happened among workers. That gives you a sense of what it would be like, because, you know, there's time, there'll be time for art, there'll be time for all things, but there'll also be time for the debates and discussions about society, about political discussion that is kept from us in the society we live in. There isn't enough time to do it. I feel like that's those important pieces of history are important to read about and learn about.
Do you have a question for her?
What's that?
Can I interrupt and ask a question?
You have to get on the list.
Okay. Hello, everybody. I'm Carson. I'm from Germany originally. First of all, I really appreciate your speech, and it was really inspiring, especially how you connect your ideas with art. And I think we all feel really connected to that. But I think we should stay. I'd like to mention 4 points. We should stick to reality if we really want to convince other people of our ideals. And we should maybe think about that. First of all, I'm also really concerned about the huge inequality between countries. But it's not really that. Just if we took the wealth of the rich and put it to poor countries, everything would be fine. This would be, for one moment in time, it would be more equal. But we have to focus on a more sustained environment. It's not about stocks. It's about flows. About an economy that is going, that is actually working. It's not just taking the money and getting it there. So we really have to have a more comprehensive thinking about economic development, and that might be, if you look at China, through capitalist reforms, they pulled 400 million workers out of absolute poverty. So we have to reconsider that it's more complex than just taking the money of the rich and giving it to the poor. Second point, I'm struggling with the concept that everyone in a socialist society will just without getting monetary incentives that like his, like to do what he does. I mean, if we look at building roads, how will we make people build roads? Is it really an intellectually enriching work that we can do? So it's you know, just an idea. Like maybe we need some kind of incentives, even in a socialist society, because there will always be work that maybe no one really intellectually enjoys. Third point, supply always exceeds demand. It's kind of also something I'm struggling with. If we say, like, if we had all of education and traveling and seeing different cultures, just take flights. Will we have an excess supply of flights? Like, just concerning climate change, concerning oil. So we won't have, like, flights for free, even, like, if we all enjoy traveling and see other cultures. This is a problem. There will always be scarcity, even in a really educated and elevated society. So this is still something, problems we have to deal with if we're being realistic and if we want to convince people. And fourth of all, fourth and last point, and I think it's really inspiring how you talk about art and everything, but we should be careful when we try to convince people that we don't like suggest that when we get rid of a capitalist society and a socialist society, everyone will be like us. Everyone will be enjoying art and will have the same ideals as we have. Because sometimes it has kind of a smack of that. That we like, I think probably we all feel really connected to what you say. But to say if we have this socialist society, everyone will enjoy art and everyone will enjoy listening to the opera. That's kind of, now many people might be offended by that because they might just enjoy cars instead of the opera. You know, it's you know, we have to be a little bit careful.
All right, next up, Bruce, followed by Cameron.
I enjoy cars and opera. I look forward to a time to be able to realize those passions. And I think that's one of the key points and one of the things that we often jump over about what a planned economy would look like, what a socialist society, a socialist economy would actually look like. Because the time and the investment that allows in terms of people's involvement and engagement in the decisions being made about society, about what to produce and so forth, that really comes from that complete deep restructuring of what work looks like under a socialist economy. The brother asked about, well, don't prices actually simplify what otherwise is a too unwieldy and too complex economic and social system to be able to figure out how to allocate resources, etc. A couple of things about that. I mean, one of Marx's key arguments about capitalism is that for the first time in history, scarcity is no longer the controlling factor of an economy. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean that there's going to be unlimited diamonds, but it does mean that at a core, root, central way, scarcity is a historical remnant that we can eliminate. That still, decisions are going to have to be made about how resources are allocated in society and so forth, and that's where the experience of revolutions, what society actually starts to look like when people have the opportunity and are actually the part of the process is in the involvement in that social decision making. Prices try to allocate but are fundamentally flawed in a systematic way, leading not only to recessions and economic crisis but also to war. And it hides where the actual value is coming from. The actual value of things in society is coming from our activity, from human activity in that society. So we need to reorganize on a democratic basis. And I think the faith in people coming together, that socialism, if you go out and talk to people about what society should be like, you're going to hear socialism on every street corner. And that's what socialism is actually about, unhitching our economic process from the profit system, from accumulation for accumulation's sake, and then let's get to work creating new ways of allocating and distributing resources.
All right, a lot of people on the list. I've got Cameron followed by Adam.
Yeah, I'll just say that I think that the one thing that I fight for as a socialist is the full development of each person, of me, depends on the full development of every person who lives in society. That's the first and foremost thing that guides me when I'm trying to figure out what kind of future social society am I fighting for. I also think that realism demands that we recognize that capitalism is killing the planet, mm-hmm. it is killing people, mm-hmm. and it is killing our future mm-hmm. to even mm-hmm. live here and exist as human beings or any other species on this planet. So realism and being realistic demands that we grapple with real things that, mm-hmm. And that learning from other people, mm-hmm. I want to address, because I think because you're talking about chauvinism, like, you know, isn't it chauvinistic to say that we want to impose opera on everybody else in the world? I think that when we tear down, Dita maybe didn't mean it that way, but I'll just put it this way. Mm-hmm. When we tear down the artificial barriers that capitalism builds between people and cultures, normally based on national boundaries where you can't cross if you don't have a passport, mm-hmm. once we start to learn from each other, all sorts of crazy, wonderful, mm-hmm. beautiful things, mm-hmm. we're going to learn about each other. And yeah, opera is going to go places, and I'm sure things I've never heard of are going to come here, and I can't wait for that day to come. And I'll close on this, and that's starving. Because I think the other thing is that we are always taught is who is going to take out the garbage? Quite frankly, if we benefit from it, we will then participate in the process of that thing. And as we do that, even garbage collection, which today is a heinous, onerous task, can be re-engineered, redesigned, mm-hmm. and we will learn about the society that we live in a way that garbage will be better handled. It won't have to be done at 3 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. You won't have to drive this big giant truck that wakes somebody up. But that applies to child care. It applies to a whole bunch of people. You benefit from it. You will participate in it. It will make us better people, yes. and it will make a better society.
I'm going to have Adam next, followed by you and the waitress.
Yeah. All right. You may have coming out. There's a lot to be said. I mean, wow. First, I just wanted to really thank you, Regina, for your talk. I mean, I think too often in the socialist movement, there's this idea, oh, Marx said that, you know, we can't, that I don't want to, you know, speculate about what the society is going to look like, and therefore, you know, we kind of shy away from these examples. And I think, you know, mm-hmm. Marx lived in a time mm-hmm. where that was, you know, capitalism was just starting to form, and it was very, very true. Whereas mm-hmm. we have not only these fabulous, ingenious artists, but also a whole history mm-hmm. of working class struggle to build on mm-hmm. and to learn from. So, yep. so the first comment I wanted to make is that 75 years ago in this city, to go into mm-hmm. 1934, mm-hmm. Right, you know, at this exact time, this entire city was shut down by the working class of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And what that, you know, Mike Quinn, I really suggest people checking out the book, The Big Strike, because he mm-hmm. talks about how, you know, we go outside, you know, it's bustling. There was no one outside. It shut down the city. Trucks weren't coming in. There were no cars. There were, you know, I mean, that's the power mm-hmm. of the working class. And I think, you know, Harry Bridges, who was a leader, a longshore leader of that strike, mm-hmm. you know, was a minority in the labor council or the strike council that was leading the general strike, arguing that we need to take over essential services mm-hmm. And expand this strike so we can last longer mm-hmm. Than a week or however, and what that would, and some strikes in 19, you know, like the Teamster strike ended up, you know, what that looked like is you had strike, you know, you'd have these businesses open that said we're open with the permission of the General Strike Council of Minneapolis or whatever. And I think that looking back at that history, sorry, Gal, you can kind of a little bit understand a little bit more what workers' power mm-hmm. Might look like under a socialist society. And I'll just, you know, and I'll, just to really quick add to the kind of, you know, the garbage collection or whatever, you know, those kind of bad jobs. I think, you know, in my workplace, I worked at Powell's Books in Portland. And, you know, with my coworkers, we always kind of joke around, like, oh, wouldn't it be great if we had, like, a masseuse during lunch? Or, you know, if someone could, like, read us a book while, you know, and if you had workers' power in a workplace, you know, whether it's picking up garbage or whatever, you could actually seriously discuss these things. Maybe we want to hire a cook to, you know, cook us lunch every day. I mean, and so even the most menial and demeaning jobs could come meaningful experiences.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Hi, my name's Lori Beth. Regina, absolutely stunning. Thank you so very much. And let's see, I have a couple of anecdotal things. Speaking of ambulances, a couple anecdotal things. One, I've been a paramedic for 20 years, recently retired, and I have to admit that I've seen absolutely the worst of the worst in situations. But there's also this other part that I've seen absolutely the best more times than not. Yep. And especially when the police aren't there. I've worked in East Oakland. I've worked in San Francisco. I've been on shootings and stabbings. Mm-hmm. And everybody clears out when there's no police. And I'm like, all right, folks, need some help. Can't tell you how many people come out of the woodwork. What can I do? What can I do?
Yep.
And we've had to carry people up hills. And you just see a line of people joining to get people up hills that ordinarily you wouldn't see. So that was one. Another one, a lot of you folks know that Larry and I got stuck at Hurricane Katrina, and we were stuck on the streets for like 8 days. And as you know, the official relief effort was flawed at best. At worst, it was absolutely criminal. Mm-hmm. And so when people say, like, there's no blueprint, one blueprint that I could say that would happen is like, people thirsty, starving, you got food, you got water, drop the damn shit, let people drink, let people eat, and then they can figure out where to go and what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Just a little anecdote on that. For example, there was a woman who completely soiled herself, shit everywhere. No one has anything, but all of a sudden it's like, anybody got a handy wipe? Someone with a baby thing, wipe someone up. Someone has clothes, someone has a top. People do come together. They will come together. Mm-hmm. They want to come together.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that things are, you know, are going to get so bad that there's a guarantee that things are, you know, going to get better? No. We can look at Nazi Germany. We can look at the United States today. We're in Iraq. Well, then let's go to Afghanistan. Instead, let's go to Iran. Let's go to Pakistan. So, no, it's not guaranteed. But I do want to say it's workshops like this, it's a conference like this, and these damn ambulances that gave me a great pension. But it's workshops like this that do instill confidence, that do instill enthusiasm, and that do give us tools to go out into the world and to take action. And I have to say, last night I saw a sunset coming home, get up a little early, and saw that sunset, and I am not going to get teary, got a little on the teary side.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for this brilliant conference and for this brilliant work.
Sarah followed by Kyle.
Yeah, in the book Socialism, Scientific, and Utopian, there's the quote that I like the best that I always think about when we get involved in different struggles, which is that the new society is going to be born out of the struggles against the old.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to imagine what a future society looks like, you look at the contradictions that are in our society right now, and you see the fights that develop into that, against those, as ways of developing you know, future society. So thinking about what would schools look like, because I'm a teacher, under socialism, if schools now are authoritarian, you know, in the future they're going to be based on student-led learning.
Mm-hmm.
If schools now are, it's crazy that schools are totally cut off from work, you know, from where stuff actually happens in society.
Mm-hmm.
They happen in these little separate buildings. You know, you can imagine schools being completely integrated with the actual life of society, and that can be part of the struggle when we're fighting for it. But I did want to say one thing about, like, I agree with what everyone's saying. Like, we want to imagine, we want to talk about what we're fighting for, but I think that, I don't know, one reason why people might say a blueprint or there's no blueprint or something is because we do have to recognize that inventing ways to win, inventing ways to fight and win, people will invent all kinds of tactics and all kinds of things that we just can't even imagine right now. So if you think about the fact that we have to solve the environmental crisis, what kinds of things are people going to invent that we don't even, haven't even imagined? So just to give one example, is like what happened in the 1930s in Flint, Michigan in 1937 when there was a huge spike at, a huge strike at a factory. And for the first time in an industrial factory, the workers decided, hey, let's not just pick it outside the factory. Let's invent something new. Let's take over the factory and occupy it so that they can't that the bosses can't just bring in scabs. And they did it, and the men went into the factory. The factory was, like, attacked by the police. People should see this documentary called With Babies and Banners.
Mm-hmm.
So the women formed a women's auxiliary and went and, like, fought the cops, and they found all these, like, they developed, like, military tactics to sort of, like, defeat the police. And in the process of it, it really was a way that men began to recognize the equality of their wives and stuff. And it was a completely, a fight against women's oppression.
Mm-hmm.
So this struggle turns to a fight against women's oppression as well. So
I
do think there's, like, an element to which the kinds of tactics we're going to have to invent to win, we have no idea.
Right
now.
Yeah.
Here. Kyle from San Francisco. Really quickly, I wanted to address the question the comrade came up about allocations of resources. I mean,
I wanted to thank you for asking the question. I think it's not a trivial question, but you know, first I think you have to cut through the ideology of capitalism and say, first off the bat, capitalism has a horrible allocation of resources all across the board.
Yep.
Fly to the commons, we produce all this stuff, you know, overconsumption, overproduction rather, underconsumption.
Yeah.
There's t-shirts, there's food, and people can't eat it. People need it. Rent is a horrible allocation of resources. The parasitic nature of intellectual property rights is a horrible allocation of resources. So let's put that on its side. What you're asking, though, is important. You know, I mean, in a transitionary economy, when we are taking over and learning how to run an economy as workers together, we'll, you know, big things, important things like steel and computers and whatnot, you know, will, how is that going to be allocated? I mean, for me personally, I would recommend reading Marx's Critique of the Gotha Program, G-O-T-H-A. It's going to be in Haymarket. You can also find it on Marx's Internet Archive. And, you know, I think certain things are going to continue to be commodities. We're going to see money on the way out, but it's not going to disappear the day after. I don't think you can come up with a blueprint per se for what a transitionary economy is going to look like, because it's going to be tied up in a thousand different ways with the historical economic and the historical political position we find ourselves in, the level of class struggle, the level of organization, etc. But even just lastly, I mean, you know, with the human ingenuity is infinite, and even things like steel and computers and whatnot, I mean, the fact that, you know, in our lifetime, just the incredible technological capabilities that we've seen generated, the synthesis of silicone and different materials and whatnot. I mean, I think you really have to open your head about, you know, what's possible. And it's a great question, but I don't think that allocation of resources arguments and even scarcity of fundamental materials arguments are insurmountable problems when you're talking about the ingenuity of the human race and the middle class.
All right. I'm going to have to ask people to wrap up quickly, but Brian, okay, next.
Yeah, I just want to, I really loved the talk too, and the thing that I really liked about it, it wasn't just about, you know, what the vision could be, it's about where we're at now, too, and how current society actually affects people and what it does. You know, the reason why Marx would come up with the blueprint is partially historical. He was actually advancing the ideas of socialism past utopians. That's all he did. They came up with their scheme, and they had no idea how they would actually get there.
Exactly.
So they just decided they would, you know, 48 used to sit, he had this great idea about how society would be different. They took out an ad, and they reappealed to the ruling class, and sat in a cafe, and waited. Nobody ever showed up. Some industrials kind of funded this project. Marx was the person that understood that the working class could actually deliver the fundamental change. That is one of the most significant contributions that he made. There are things actually that grow out of that immediately. Because we do not, as I think Regina actually really did a good job of pointing out, we don't idealize where the working class is now. What we say, however, though, is that by coming in together in struggle, people are fundamentally transformed in ways we can only begin to imagine, especially now when that struggle has been almost entirely absent. You know, people don't, you know, when the level of struggle is high, people don't go to church. They don't talk about spirituality that much, because they actually see the real, living, inspirational human spirit right in front of them. They feel less alienated from the people around them. That's one of the ways that they're fundamentally changed. What Marx talked about is people will become fit to rule. That is a process that we are beginning to see unfold in small ways in front of us by people like Jack Bison coming to the coming to the panel on HA and standing in solidarity with the brothers and sisters in the LGBT community. We're beginning to see that develop around us, and it's a tremendously inspirational. In terms of solving the big social problems, another reason why we don't prefigure it is because it's not democratic. It's not democratic for us to come up with some kind of a sketch. And it actually, at the end of the day, it confines working class. Lenin understood that so remarkably well. What he said is that every cook shall govern. He had an enormous faith in the creative capacity of the working class, and unfortunately, the Russian Revolution, you only got to see the beginnings of that tremendous flowering before it was cut short by the invasion of all the capitalist armies that wanted to crush that example. And we need to bring forward, you know, the inspiration of that revolution.
Can you wrap up, please?
What we're talking about is a confidence that I share in the creative capacity of the working class. When we talk about a revolution, comrades, we're talking about a turning. where the people on the bottom, they become the top. They can easily, with their imagination, if they can make the revolution by God running the society at the current level of technology and what it can deliver, is child's play compared to the task of getting there.
Really quickly on the opera thing, the way I took the opera thing is that opera would be an option for everyone.
Yeah.
And people could enjoy it or not without the constraints of assuming it was bourgeois. If they liked it, it wasn't, or didn't like it, it wasn't because it was bourgeois. So my question is, and it's been a long time since I've studied Marxist theory, so bear with me, is that, you know, Marx said that when things get really bad, the working class is going to, you know, get together and create this great revolution, and then Germany's really, really bad after World War I, and everyone's like, it's going to happen, and then Nazism happens instead, and afterwards everyone's like, what the fuck happened? And so nationalism took over, and people became really, really cruel. So my question is, what can we do? Like, how society can we make sure that things go, because, I mean, obviously we're not there yet, but things are going to get really bad as things get more and more scarce, so how do we make sure we don't go back to Nazism, instead we make sure the revolution goes the right direction, you know? So, my question.
I'm not quite sure how to answer that question, so I'll just talk about what I was saying, which is one of the key things about winning socialism is that working class people will have more time, more power, more resources, all the things they don't have right now. And so the whole question, people will address this, but the issue of a blueprint is that actually, you know, the quote by Trotsky where it says, everyone will be a Shakespeare, everyone will be a Marx, everyone will be a Goethe. We have one Shakespeare, one Marx, one Goethe. And there are millions of people who have the opportunities to do that. They will have much better ideas than any of us could figure out right. We get the smartest people in the world right now to put together a blueprint. It'll probably be pretty good, but it won't be nearly as good as what they would be able to come up in the future. And that gets to the question about, you know, how do you, you know, dealing with third world countries and inequality. Yes, there's an inequality. They'll have to be redistributed so that poorer countries and other parts of the world have more wealth to take care of themselves. But the real issue is going to be those third world workers will have to take over their societies and run them themselves. You know, poor, illiterate peasants in China will actually be much more effective and efficient at running their own societies than the people who are running it right now or the people who are running this country right now. That will be the fundamental change. We'll be able to, you know, richer countries will be able to give them the opportunity to use that human wealth in order to build a much better society than they have right now.
All right, one more speaker in the back there, and then I'm going to have to cut off the list. I apologize. Just about 8 more people on the list.
I want to underscore a point that Regina made in her excellent talk about how capitalism actually distorts the way we feel about work today. And I would say that's why it is so difficult for us to actually really conceptualize what life is going to be like outside of capitalism, because we are products of it. So I'm speaking as a woman who has a master's degree in art, and I have a job in which, during the school year at the university, I spend 2 hours every morning dumping garbage into a dumpster. That's my job. I've also laid roads. We have, you know, a brother from Germany who said, is there really anything that creative about laying out a road? Where is it? I have to admit, I actually get my kicks out of laying brick and seeing a gorgeous pathway.
That's right.
If I have ownership over that project or if I don't.
Yep.
Dumping the garbage. Another thing that Regina spoke about is, as products of our society, we carry all the ugly sides of ourselves. As a socialist, I didn't like feeling embarrassed to be an educated, highly educated woman dumping garbage. And I realized that easily half of the problem of garbage is the stigma associated with that and with those jobs.
Right.
Yep. So I think that you take that out, and already that's half the nastiness. People who collect garbage, we have ideas about better ways to do it.
Right.
The worst thing about garbage is the bio waste. We have ways to deal with that now. When you're left with paper and ashes, no problem. That's a pretty clean thing. The other cool thing about my job is I work with a fairly politicized man. So the 2 hours we spend is an opportunity for us to have, say, a debate over whose funeral will be bigger. Michael Jackson's worldwide or when Muhammad Ali dies. And that can be a very political, interesting discussion. Imagine a world where we all get to think like that. And I was trying to think here, just to wrap up, I don't want to romanticize ugly jobs, because there is that, but what about taking care of the laundry and the diapers in hospitals? That would be reimagined when we have a society in which we fundamentally value all of our seniors, all of our people who are ill. When your grandma is my grandma,
Yep, that's
that
right.
Feels different, and it is a fundamental spiritual change. Mm-hmm. The way we regard our own waste or our own healing, when we are one with the process of aging and birth, imagine the incredible spiritual depth and you know, and connection that we will have all together. Mm-hmm. And for me, that is the level to which we handle that is the testament, is the amount of success that we have created our own world.
All right, we went a little over time in the interest of a great discussion, so we're going to have to haul ass over to the Women's Building for the final rally, which starts at 1:30. Just quickly,
but I'm gonna wrap.
Regina's going to wrap up.
So don't leave yet.
Don't leave yet. Quickly, Revolutionary Rehearsals, with a great book, Glimpses of Workers' Power Through the Lens of Five Revolutionary Upheavals, Art and Revolution by Leon Trotsky, The Meaning of Marxism by Paul D'Amato, Teamster Rebellion. There's so many more books in there that are relevant.
Anything.
Go ahead.
Any book, practically, in the Haymarket Room. I know we're getting close on time. I'll just read a couple sentences from Teamsters Rebellion, the strike that took place in Minneapolis. Basically the organization that workers had, and people have mentioned the other strikes and revolutions in which this is taking place also. So when the sun rose on May 16th, 1934, the headquarters at 1900 Chicago Avenue was a beehive of activity. Union carpenters and plumbers were installing gas stoves, sinks, and serving counters in the commissary. The Cooks and Waiters Union sent experts on mass cooking and serving to help organize things and train the volunteer help. Working in two 12-hour shifts, over 100 volunteers served 4,000 to 5,000 people daily. Sandwiches and coffee were available. It goes on to basically say, the amount of organization that took place in that city, like from roving picket lines to take care of and support the strikers, but at the same time, like, allowing food to come in and distribution. I mean, how quickly, like, there's so much bureaucracy that's actually wrapped up in capitalism. You take that away, and there's so much that we can actually do much more quickly and help. And the way that Lori Beth talked about what happened in New Orleans, I think, is a great example. So I don't want to go on too long, but I will say, I think it's actually elitist of us to say that ordinary people don't want access to art and creativity. I mean, the Russian Revolution has amazing stories of what happened. I mean, they basically opened up the theaters and the opera houses, and I wanted to find some of these pictures, but you had thousands upon thousands of people who had never heard this music, never access to this culture before, workers who were just basically, like, in dirty clothes and, you know, who had been fighting, you know, in the Civil War, came in and listened to this music and just were completely transformed about their access to art and culture. You also had the soldiers who the literacy rate, like, grew so quickly. People wanted to read. There was a culture of reading and wanting to understand history. You had people within the Red Army who were learning to read and write on each other's backs as they were marching through and fighting the White Army. So I think we can't even begin to understand how much people will want to learn and take part and have access to these things. Just, I will wrap up on this. Your question is a long one. There was two other talks at the same time that will address these questions on how the Russian Revolution was lost and also what happened with Germany and fascism. But I will say, Russia, you know, again, what happened was because of scarcity. Anytime you have scarcity, you're going to have a bureaucracy that basically has to control and distribute and ration things. Like, that is not the society that we're talking about. And two, how do we keep from having, you know, some sort of class basically come after us and, like, win the revolution? We have to build a revolutionary party today. We have to participate in the struggles that are going on today so that actually we're strong enough to fight those battles ahead and that we'll be able to basically, you know, build and transform and make the kind of world that we started discussing in this room today. So if you're not a member of the ISO, you should join. So you can talk to me about that or a lot of other folks who are in this room. So thanks, everybody. Enjoy the rally.